Are you ready to lose those love handles? Do you work hard to stay in shape and eat healthy, yet you can't get rid of stubborn fat? Now there's a clinically proven way to help you look slimmer without surgery or downtime. It's called Sculpture. Sculpture's innovative procedure destroys fat in just 25 minutes with visible results as quickly as 6 weeks. Sculpture sounds amazing, right? Check it out for yourself by clicking on the banner or go to goodbyefat.com.
Blog Talk Radio.
Best-selling and award-winning author of true crime and crime fiction, Yvonne Mason is back with a brand new book, The Pink Canary, a book that delves into the life of a drag queen and a marvelous whodunit. You can find this and all of Yvonne's other works on Amazon.com or find Yvonne Mason on Facebook and Twitter.
You're gonna kill me.
Buy your copy of Pink Canary now.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is Thursday night. This is Off the Chain. I am your host, Yvonne Mason. And, of course, that was a peaceless, shameful promotion because that's what I do. That was my ad man, Christopher Dunham, and he is doing my book, The Pink Canary. And if you have not read The Pink Canary, you should, because it involves a drag queen who is also a private investigator who owns her own club down on Duval Street in Key West. It's called The Pink Canary. And she and a friend of hers, who is a detective, are cleaning up a mess that goes all the way back to New York. And in this book is a friend of mine who always said that the only way he was going to get famous was to die in a plane crash. And I said, well, you don't have to die in a plane crash now because you're in one of my books. And the character in the book, the name is Penelope, and it is my really, really good friend, Peter Fondura. His picture is at the end of the book, dressed in drag, and when you see him, you'll understand Penelope. So go and order that book. No, you cannot go now. You have to wait till after the show's tonight. But order The Pink Canary and read it and fall down laughing. Now, this morning when I ran the numbers, which I do every morning because I'm a nosy kind of girl, this show alone, just on Blog Talk, is at 5,523 listeners. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we started this show on July the 27th of last year. Show's not even a year old yet, and my goal then was to have 5,000 listeners by the end of the year just on the show. Well, then we got to 5,000 listeners with the show and all the podcasts. So then I said, okay, let's go 10,000. Well, we got 10,000 with the show and all the podcasts. So I said, let's go 15,000. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we are 2,000 short of 15,000, including this show and all of the podcasts. So we're going to go for 20,000 by the end of the year. This show's heard in over 50 countries, some of the countries I never even heard of. This morning we added Italy to the countries that listen to the show. And on Blog Talk alone, our friends from Down Under in Australia is our biggest listener, and coming in second is our friends from Canada. So the USA is sort of slacking on Blog Talk because Canada and Australia, they're beating you out. So, ladies and gentlemen, you need to tell your friends, share this network, because this show is growing and we have a plethora of guests. You never know what we're going to do. Show's not scripted. I have notes, but, hey, I just go where the conversation leads when the guest is on. And speaking of guests, tonight my guest is from Canada. Her name is Sarah McAdam. And she is a musician and a songwriter. And while she was dealing with some, and I hate using this word, I was telling her before the show, I hate using this word. We would just say some issues with her psychic. And she was put out of work and sent back to her home in Fredericton, New Brunswick. So then she decided, being the very smart girl that she is, that she would turn to her best friends for support. Because, ladies and gentlemen, when you are dealing with issues of the mind, the worst thing you can do is close yourself off from the world. So she included her brother from another mother and her duo mate, Greg. Now, Greg had been living out west, and he was working hard to make a life for himself and for his daughter back home in New Brunswick. So one night, Greg called Sarah, said that after 2 years, he couldn't stand being away from his friends and his family, his local music scene, and most importantly, his daughter any longer. Music had always been a beautiful solace to all of them, and they had been playing in a duo together off and on for over 10 years. So in their mutual need of something to make it all worth it, Greg made the decision to move back east with the plan of starting a rock band. He actually booked his ticket the night that he talked to Sarah. Brian, the lead guitar, the cat aficionado, was an obvious choice to add to the group, as he, Greg, and Sarah had been friends longer than any of them could remember. And Brian is beyond good. His solos make people feel. And he and Greg once played in a band together that featured Brian's cat. This is going to be so much fun tonight, finding out about all this stuff. So, without further ado, let's welcome our guest from the cold country, Miss Sarah McAdam. Welcome to the show. I am so glad to have you with me tonight.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
Well, we didn't get your music, so now you've got to come back so we can play your music and talk about your music, because I know that your music has helped heal in so many ways. But before we get to that, tell me a little bit about your history, Sarah. Have you always been someone that wanted to play, to sing, to be around music?
I was always a little performer, and from the time that I was born, and very much early songwriter, singer. I used to sing my dad songs that I would make up as we were driving around when I was about 5 years old. I think that habit started, and I've been in love with music ever since. But I didn't ever really participate in it professionally or in any sort of, you know, pursuing my own music career way. I was a promoter. I figured that I didn't have what it took to be on stage, but I was happy to be in the background and making shows happen. So for years, for 15 years, I set up shows for bands. And then when that faded out and I got into jobs that didn't really allow the opportunity, the time to set up various shows for touring bands and stuff, I would still allow them to stay at my house. And actually, I even have a band staying over at my house last night and tonight because of those years of promoting and just all these connections with bands and from years of booking them. Now it's just turned into kind of being the tour mom.
Well, let me ask you
something. So I've sort of always been in the music.
During the times that you were promoting the bands, first of all, why did you feel you were not good enough to sing? And that segues into, while you were promoting these bands, did you feel like there was something missing in your heart? Because the heart wants what the heart wants. And when we have those dreams, they don't die.
I would say that I was told very early that singing is not a realistic career choice, and that that's not something to spend my life pursuing. So I didn't ever give it too much of a thought until I needed an outlet. And then when I needed an outlet for all of the stuff, all the chaos going on inside, then I kind of came back to it in that way. So I think that for me, it was never something that I took. That I allowed myself to take seriously. It wasn't something that I allowed myself to even dream about, because it was just totally unrealistic as far as I had ever been told. But now I'm learning that, you know, you can pursue what truly resonates with you and maybe have that work out a little.
Well, the thing is, when someone tells us that, because growing up I was always told I wasn't good enough to be a writer. It was always poor, pitiful Yvonne. And like you, I didn't pursue it. And I could kick myself now because I wasn't strong enough to tell them to go take a dive somewhere.
Right.
But when someone does that to another human being, it sets about to destroy any shred of self-confidence that person has. Now, realistically or not, that was your dream, and you were entitled to that. And how did they know it wasn't realistic if you hadn't even attempted it yet? They didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
So would it be a safe assumption to say that all those years wasted, which you can't go back and get, might on the flip side make you stronger now to say, I just want to thank all those people that told me no for all those years?
Oh, yeah. And I would say that it's now, I've gotten to a point in my life where I have the confidence to say, okay, well, maybe I can't do it. If you say I can't, well, maybe you're right, but I don't really care. I'm just going to do it anyway.
There you go. And that's where we have to get in our life, because, number one, would you agree, Sarah, life is too cotton-picking short to allow someone else to say, you can't do this. And number two, you don't want to be that person at the end of your days either.
Life's
you want
too
to say,
short to not live it.
Exactly. Now, that all being said, as these people were telling you, you can't, you can't, you can't, did that affect you in other areas of your life as far as believing in who Sarah McAdam was?
Oh, I'm sure. I've been the weirdo my entire life, the performer and the weirdo. But I'm happy with how things have turned out, because if everything hadn't happened as it did, then I wouldn't be exactly where I am now, and where I am now is just okay. So I'm happy to be here.
What led you to finally make that decision? It doesn't matter if it's not a realistic dream. And the reason I ask these questions is because I know I have viewers out there that go through the same thing. They have dreams, but someone said, well, you can't because it's not realistic, or you can't because there's too many out there. You can't for this reason or that reason, whatever that dream is.
Right.
So they struggle with, but I really want to, but I can't. So what made you decide that it doesn't matter if they say it's not realistic and just say, forget you, I'm going to do this, and if I fall on my face, I fall on my face, I still succeeded because I've tried?
Right. Well, for me, it was genuinely pure desperation. I got to a point where I had broken my head. I had been working in a job that was very taxing, and it took a lot out of me. And at the end of the day, I didn't have anything left to look after myself. And so after that went on for a couple years, I just got to a place where I wasn't okay. I was so far from okay that I didn't ever believe that I would be okay again. And music was the possible outlet. It was something that I was capable of doing, something that if I couldn't do anything else, and some days I mean literally anything else, to look after myself, that I could always sing. And so that was one thing that I could do to try and get back to some semblance of being a whole person.
So without the ability, or you have the ability, without the outlet to be able to sing, and this is true with anyone that has a dream, whether it's an artist, a writer, a business person, if we don't have that outlet, for whatever reason it's taken away from us, it's almost as if we're dying inside. Would that be a fair statement?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that there's something inside of us that, if we don't foster what it is that we're here to do, what it is that we truly feel resonates with us, then yeah, there's a little part of us that starts to curl up and give up and get weaker and softer and die. And that part of us is very much a part of the whole picture of ourselves. and not having that certainly fundamentally changes who a person is. So if we're not fostering, all of the elements of ourselves, then we're killing parts of ourselves off.
And I think once we do that, it's very hard to get it back, because it's like a flower. If you don't water it, it dies. And once it dies, it usually doesn't come back.
I think for a lot of people, that's kind of the tragic story, is that they have a genuine talent, and they don't sharpen it and work with it and invest themselves into it and allow themselves to develop it and allow themselves to not just putting in the time and practicing and that kind of thing, but actually allowing themselves to invest part of their soul into what they're doing in this real way that fosters a healthy sense of self. Then I think that it's not that the talent goes away or that the ability or that even their opportunity goes away, because I don't think it's ever too late in life for anybody to really go for their genius. For their dreams and achieve something amazing. But I do think that it can be so much harder to try and fight back after all the years of scar tissue built up on your soul. You know, all these years of telling yourself no, because you let somebody else say no, and then so you say no to yourself.
And then you believe it.
Right.
One begins to believe, well, I'm really not that talented anyway, so why do I want to waste my time when I could be doing something else that I'm really not happy about, but it's called survival.
Right.
When you were so far down in the rabbit hole, and ladies and gentlemen, those of you that say, well, I don't get in the rabbit hole, stop lying to yourself, because we all do. Things happen in our lives. There are circumstances. There are things that happen. So anyone that says, well, I'm always happy, stop lying to yourself. When Sarah was so far down in her hole, that's when you contacted your friend Greg, correct?
Right. Yeah, called him crying.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I was sitting in a hotel room in Quebec, far away from home, and by myself, and crying, and had just been put off work and told that I needed to go home and see my family doctor, and needed to be off work, and that I wasn't going to be returning for a while. And so that was pretty identity crushing, because everything about myself that I liked about myself that I was proud of was tied up in this job that I was very proud of. So I lost my sense of self in a heartbeat and didn't know what to do, didn't know who to reach out to, didn't know how to process. And the only person that I could think of that I thought I would be able to talk to was Greg. And so even knowing that he was far too busy with his crazy life out west, trying to make money to send home to his family and working all the time and everything, I gave it a shot anyway and called him and managed to get a hold of him. And we talked for hours, and he calmed me down a lot, and he cried and I cried, and he talked about how he wanted to be home. And I said, well, you know, I'm going to be home, and let's do music. And so we started talking about forming a band, and it just gave me something to hang on to. It gave me a reason to get up in the morning. It gave me a reason to live, honestly. More than anything else, it was a reason to not kill myself was why we started the band.
And that's very important, because from what I've studied about you, you were at your lowest ebb, and when someone else cut your legs out from under you and said, well, you can't do this anymore because basically you're not good enough, that completely shredded you to the point that you thought, what difference does it make if I live or die? I'm just taking up somebody else's air. Would that be a true statement?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'd say you've done your research well.
So Greg got a ticket that night and came home.
Pretty much, yeah. He booked his ticket that night, and he was home April 1st. We actually just celebrated his 2-year home anniversary.
And that was the beginning of Panda Bee Catastrophe.
Right. Somehow we talked Brian into it. He's such a ridiculously good guitar player, and he's also an audio engineer, so he engineers all the albums for the band. And I don't know how we talked him into it. He's so busy, and he agreed, and he loved it. And we talked in this ridiculously good bass player, Andrew Flynn, who was a friend of Brian's. So Brian asked him to join, and I think he and Greg knew each other from way back, too, because it's a small town, New Brunswick. But we talked these two ridiculously talented, really great guys into joining the band with us, again, on this idea that, you know, hey, Sarah needs to save her life. She needs something. She needs a reason to live. So we're doing this band. Will you please do this with us? Sarah's got 15 years promoting experience. She'll get us gigs, so it's not going to be a complete waste of your time. Let's do this. And they jumped on board and were happy to basically contribute their time to my mental health for the true way of music, you know?
And that is what someone who starts falling down into that rabbit hole needs more than anything, is a support group that doesn't want to psychoanalyze you, that doesn't want to say, get over it. They apparently just accepted you where you were and were there every time you fell down and picked you back up and dusted you off and said, let's keep moving forward. Never criticized, never put down, just gave you all the love and support that you need to help you heal and to put you back together again, stronger than you were before.
Yep, they're my family.
Why did y'all call yourself the Panda Bee Catastrophe?
So it started as Panda Bee, just Panda Bee. And Brian added catastrophe because it sounds better and it better tells our story. How this band formed, you know our story, the emotional side of things, but we don't know about the personalities of the band. Everyone else in the band besides me is metalhead.
And I
grew up punk rock. And I grew up punk rock. So we all have these really hard music backgrounds, very different from the music that we play. But what we wanted to play is something that we grew up listening to as well. We all grew up listening to 90s alt rock. And we wanted to play a lot more along the theme of 90s alt rock, which is also a lot more marketable. People want to hear 90s alt rock a lot more often than you can just play a CD, a 90s alt rock CD somewhere. Whereas if you put in one of our metal CDs or one of our punk CDs, people are not necessarily as quick to say, oh yeah, sure, leave that playing for the next hour. So we wanted something that people wanted to hear, and we also wanted to make music that we wanted to play. So we formed Panda Bee Catastrophe with this name, this cute name, Panda Bee Catastrophe, you know, this adorable name, covering up this very dark reason behind it. And the dark secret reason behind Panda Bee Catastrophe is that all the pandas and all the bees are dying, and that is our fault, and it's a terrible catastrophe. And we're trying to shed light in all of our songs on different things going on in the world, be they in the emotional world or in the physical world, that are going on that need to have light shed on them. And one of those things is the fact that we are destroying the earth, and we need to take responsibility for that and do everything we can to start turning it around. So if we're going to have to say something 10,000 times, every time somebody says, what's your band name? If we're going to have to say something over and over and over, it better be worth saying. So Panda Bee Catastrophe, because that's worth saying.
I love it. That is
Thanks. Perfect. Thanks.
And it makes
so
much
sense. But it sounds huge, right?
Yeah, it's simple. It makes perfect sense. And it makes a statement.
But much like our music, it sounds adorable.
Yeah. That is amazing. That is absolutely amazing. Now, the first song that you guys wrote together, the first four lines, ladies and gentlemen, are poignant. And I can relate to Sarah because I fight depression a lot. It's rampant in my family, but every time it rears its ugly head, I just slap it back down. I don't have time for it anymore. I'm too old for one thing. For another thing, it takes up too much energy for me to do. But the first four lines of their first song is pay attention to it, because it makes a huge, huge statement. So, and any of you out there that are fighting depression and are struggling to get through one more hour because you don't think you're good enough, well, you are. Everybody's got a purpose. The first four lines go, "We started playing together to save my life. My head was broken, my heart all strife. Metalheads, rockers, stoners, everyday zeros. Things may be different, but you're still my heroes." Now that you've told me the background of the band, this makes perfect sense. Because what you, if I'm reading the lyrics right, if I'm understanding the lyrics right, you're saying
yeah.
we all, the four of us, come from different musical backgrounds. That being said, we have all come together for a common cause, and that is to save my life. And now not only are you, and we've been considered zeros in the population of the world because we're metalheads and rockers and stoners, but you are still my heroes because you are the ones that have helped keep me grounded.
Absolutely. Yep, absolutely.
That makes perfect sense. How in the world, Sarah, and we all wear a mask, I know that because I wore a mask for a long, long time. You walk out the door, you put the mask on, and you go to your place of business, and you leave the mask on, and you come home, and you take the mask off. How in the world did you get on stage night after night and that mask not slip? Because ladies and gentlemen, if you've never been on stage, it can get stressful. Even though you're hyped up and you're excited, that can be one of the most stressful environments out there. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, I would say so. I think that's why alcoholism and drug use is so rampant in the music industry now. I think it's one of the most stressful occupations you can choose.
How did you, because you were already in a vulnerable position, emotionally and mentally, how did you find the strength to go on stage night after night and wear that mask and make everybody think that your world was not on full tilt?
I think it's, in a way, it's the only place that I don't have to wear the mask. When I'm on stage, I'm surrounded in my guys, my band, that all have my back, and that if no matter what happens, and absolutely no matter what happens, apocalyptic things could happen, or somebody could throw a bottle, or somebody could heckle, or, you know, my worst nightmares could come true, and they would all defend me. They would have my back, and they would look after me. And so that kind of gives me strength to be able to go out there and not have to wear a mask and just actually really, truly relate to people. And you know, if I've had a bad day, then it's pretty hard for me to have a bad day once I get up there in front of an audience and lights are on and, you know, my favorite microphone's in front of me and my band's there. It's pretty hard to be in a bad mood. But if I have had a bad day and I'm not feeling the best when I go out there, then I find it's okay to let that come through in the singing, you know, let the sorrow of whatever's been happening come through in the parts of the songs that it makes sense that you'd be a little sad. So I just find being 100% real on stage is what's actually enabled me to do anything. It's what's enabled me to leave my house in other capacities. It's what's allowed me to do anything to look after myself otherwise is that first hurdle was letting the mask slip off entirely and letting that be okay for an hour and a half at a time while singing my heart out.
Now, you said something really interesting, and this has been a burning question that I've had for a while. When you talk about having your favorite microphone, what most of the public doesn't understand. As artists, we have our favorite things. I have my favorite computer, my favorite pen, my favorite notebook. It's the same thing with your microphone. How does it become your favorite?
This one, for me, I had lusted after this microphone for quite a while. And I had wanted one of the old-style microphones, but I specifically wanted one by Shure because I'm familiar with the diaphragm and familiar with how they work and how they sound and how my voice sounds coming through it. So I wanted something that was really similar to an SM58, which is that really basic, standard karaoke microphone that everybody has everywhere. And if they don't have an SM58, they have a Beta 58, which is basically the same thing by a different company. But so it has a similar internal workings, but has a different grill on the outside and is set up just a little bit different. Basically, the microphone that I have is it looks like an old style microphone, but picks up with all of the modern technology and high quality. So it's the best of both worlds. And it also opens up where it picks up sound from to a much broader space. So it can record all of the, it can pick up all of the sounds that are coming from the back of my throat and the front of my throat and the tip of my tongue and everywhere. So I kind of got lost in there. I think I forgot your question. We're just going on about
No, that was perfect because what you're saying is your favorite microphone. It's not just a microphone. It is an extension of your voice and of your singing.
Absolutely.
And without it,
yeah,
you might not feel as comfortable singing. Would that be a fair statement?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm far more comfortable singing in front of a microphone than without. By far.
When the four of y'all got together and you started writing music, was it more rock? Was it more metal? Was it something in between? How did y'all reach a happy medium with such a mixture of personalities and music genres among you?
We all knew that what we wanted to write had a 90s alt rock, just a touch of funky, jammy sound, that we really wanted that. We wanted the music, the bulk of the music of the band, to be that crushing, screaming guitar riffs, but, you know, complemented with nice melodic harmonies and just that all-over 90s alt-rock sound. We really wanted that. Everybody in the band wanted it. And so it was easy to agree that that's the direction we were going to take things. And then as we all started laying our parts in, we get inspired by what each other is doing. None of us will go and just write an entire song by ourselves and pass out sheet music to everybody else and say, this is what you're playing. So it's a very collaborative thing. So it means that if one person writes something that sounds a little bit more funky than usually our bassist, Flynn, if he writes something a little bit more funky, then we all kind of tailor a little bit more to that. And then my vocals are a little bit different from what you would expect out of 90s alt rock, because female vocalists in the 90s were pretty much Courtney Love and kind of in that direction. And I'm not exactly in that direction. In that song that we had talked about earlier, I Think I'm in Love with the Band, I almost go for an intentionally cute voice, so that is if you were talking to someone that you're in love with, because that's what the song is really about, that, you know, I didn't need a partner, I don't need anything, I've got my band, you know, so I take my voice in that way. But on other songs, I'll go a lot more grungy and more inspired by kind of the male vocalists that have inspired me growing up, but, you know, Trent Reznor from Nine Inch Nails and Dave Grohl from Foo Fighters, and then a lot of independent punk bands that I listened to growing up that no one's ever heard of because they're from the East Coast of Canada. So a lot of times I take my voice more that way, but it always lumps into that same 90s alt-rock feel. So if you took our music and put it on the radio in the 90s, it would make total sense. And so we have that common thread, and so it's easy to stick within that.
Would it be a fair statement to say that sound is beginning to make its way back?
Oh, I hope so. I hope so with everything I am.
Well, because I hear a lot of the newer music, and it has that 90s flavor to it. The Nine Inch Nails
agree.
And the the just went right out of my head, the one that sings I'm Your Kryptonite, and I can't even think of who it is.
Yeah.
It was on the tip of my tongue, and I lost it. I have the song, and I lost it.
Is Kryptonite Matchbox 20, or is that the other one? I can't remember either. I listened to it the other day, which is even worse. But that genre of music, I guess, if it's coming back around, it kind of makes sense as things tend to roll in those waves, you know. And
mm-hmm.
and it's about time. And I mean, Nine Inch Nails is still going. Like Trent Reznor will never stop making albums. So I mean, thank the music gods. Trent Reznor will never stop making albums. I think that if it is coming back, it's just kind of its time, and maybe if we're on the right crest of that wave, then people will hear something in our music that resonates with them in the same way that, you know, that it lines up in time with the rest of the bands that are getting some of that sound in.
And that's why you've got to come back, because I did not realize that your albums were already out. If I had, I would have downloaded your music. We would have played your music and talked about it. So I have to bring you back so we can do that, because, ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't gone to listen to Sarah McAdams and the Panda Bee Catastrophe, they can be found on SoundCloud and Bandcamp and their website, Panda Bee Catastrophe. That will direct you where you need to go, because these guys are exploding on the scene. It's not if, it's when, and y'all want to be there with them. And I know that you said it's not about getting famous or making millions or being known. It's about getting Panda Bee Catastrophe to a place where there is a main source of income, and to cover all your expenses and all that. That being said, it's sweet justice, in my humble opinion, that y'all are becoming famous, and I see it coming, especially after you were told it's not a realistic dream.
Hmm. Well, thanks. I hope that those people that told me that it's not possible are listening.
Well, if not, they will be, because Sarah, it was not meant for you to come this far, for it not to happen.
Hmm.
Because you were so on the edge of that precipice, it could have gone either way.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And it went the right way. So there are good things coming, and with your background as a promoter, you're already halfway there.
I feel pretty lucky that we've got Brian as an audio engineer as well, and then we've picked up two more members on top of the original four. One of them, our keyboard player, who goes by Ivo Shandor, is also a videographer, so he does all of our videography for the band as well, which is why we're able to put out music videos too. So if you check us out on YouTube, we've got a music video called Workaday Jane that he did all the directing and everything for. It's really cool. And he'll be doing all the rest of our videos. He's got all of our lyric videos up there. It's awesome. So we're pretty lucky to have extra talents in the band beyond the musical talent as well, and the extra training. You know, Brian being trained as an audio engineer, and Greg has been working with me on doing bookings as well, because he's been booking himself forever. So it's just a hop, skip, and a jump to being able to help set up tours and all that. So
are y'all,
we also have go ahead. Our drummer is a rapper, so in his part-time. So he also brings a totally different element to it. In the music scene, he understands things about the music scene on sides of things that we would have never thought of. So it's pretty well-rounded.
So do y'all go all over? And Canada's a huge country. Do you go all over Canada, or are you just situated on the East Coast at the present time?
We just did, well, last summer we did a cross-Canada tour, and we went all the way to the West Coast, put our feet in the opposite ocean, and had a really great time, learned a lot, met a lot of really great bands and contacts and venues and had so much fun in places that we had no idea were as amazing as it. We didn't know Thunder Bay was so cool. Thunder Bay is this place in Ontario that, you know, it's the place that you get gas, and we didn't realize that it's actually like the coolest university party scene we've ever found. And so we played there twice and had an amazing time. You know, we played on the West Coast and played all through the prairies and played in Alberta, and it was really great. We had a beautiful month living in a van and exposing people to some East Coast 90s alt rock. But since then, we've been doing pretty much around Fredericton and around New Brunswick. We go and play a few hours away every once in a while, but mostly sticking close to home. Just played in Halifax last weekend. And now at the end of this month, we're going to be going to Prince Edward Island on April 29th. And then May 3rd, 4th, and 5th, we're playing in Newfoundland at CBTG's, you know, on George Street, which is like the party street in Newfoundland. If you're going to Newfoundland, you're going to George Street, basically. So it should be a pretty spectacular time. So we'll be traveling. So now we will have finally we've gone all the way to the farthest coast. Now we will finally have gone as far as you possibly can on the East Coast, and then we're going to be going back west as far as Winnipeg in September. And it looks like we're going to be spending a lot of time in Southern Ontario. So if you have any listeners in Southern Ontario, they should definitely check out our stuff and get prepared for a lot of shows.
Yeah. Now, do you, in your travels, there's another band from Ontario, and
yes.
Cypher knows them, Diogre.
Yes.
You know them too?
Only vaguely. Yeah, I've listened to a few, or I've watched a few of the videos and heard some of his music. Heard some of their music.
You need to hook up with them too, because I've interviewed them a couple. They're coming back on the show too. So
nice.
I have three, ladies and gentlemen, I have three bands out of the country of Canada that I'm absolutely in love with. And I'm going to bring Sarah back because I want to play her music. Her music, I've not heard it yet, but I can guarantee you it is killer. You want to go get it. It's called Panda Bee Catastrophe. You want to go get their music, because when they come to the States and there's tickets on sale and somebody says, well, who are they? You can say, oh, I know these guys. They rock. Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah, well, I hope so, yeah. Yeah. It will be a while before we're going to the States, but when we do, it's going to be a big tour. We plan on not just going down one coast to the other. We want to basically do a box and drive the perimeter of the entire country.
You will love it, and they will love you. And if I'm still around, it would be so cool to do a live remote with y'all.
Oh, that would be so cool.
Wouldn't that be cool? Come to South Florida. We'll do a live remote and have y'all there. Do a live remote either before or after the show or the day before the show or something when you're not so crazy. And then we'll put it up on Blog Talk and all the podcasts. That would be so cool.
That would be amazing. Yeah, we would love that.
And we can make this happen.
Nice.
Because and I'm serious, I see you going very far. Because the more I studied your bio, and the more I studied Sarah McAdam, and the more I've watched your page, and ladies and gentlemen, I do all this. I study my guests because I don't know if Sarah knows or not, but before I moved to Florida, I was a bounty hunter in Georgia.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Yeah, I study people. And there's something about you that's special.
Thank you.
And I felt it.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
And I'm so upset with myself because I don't have your music, because I really didn't think that your albums were out there. But you do have two albums out, correct?
Yes. Yeah, The Argus Files, named after my dog, and Consent is Sexy.
and they're on SoundCloud and Bandcamp, and
they and pandabecatastrophe.com, and it'll direct you everywhere to all of our music and all of our links and all of our merch and everything.
Have you put it up on iTunes yet?
No, we haven't yet, but when we do our next album, we're going to be putting that on iTunes.
Okay. So watch for it, ladies and gentlemen. They'll be putting their music on iTunes, and then you can buy it from iTunes and download it. And then you can say, yes, I know this band, and they are the band of now. And if you like the 90s rock music, the Nine Inch Nails and the one that I can't think of, you will love these guys because they are absolutely fantastic. Now, I ask, we are almost at the end of our show, believe it or not. I ask.
Oh, wow. Time's going by.
It does. It flies by. I ask all of my guests, and we talked about this briefly, and you had that happen to you, that you had a dream, and someone said, well, it's not a realistic dream. Don't pursue it. If someone came to you today and said, Sarah, I have this dream. I want to be a master painter or a master craftsman or a master builder or whatever, but someone said I couldn't do it, what would you tell them?
Just do that thing. Do the thing. Do the thing that your life tells you that you need to do. Nobody else knows better than your own intuition. And I truly believe that the universe tells us what we need to know. And so if something is coming up in your head that says, I want to do this, and this is what I think that I should be doing with myself, then it is what you're supposed to be doing with yourself. And maybe it's not even forever. Maybe that doesn't mean that you're going to be a master painter forever. Maybe that just means that you're going to do everything that you can in painting for an amount of time, and somewhere along that way, you'll discover that, yeah, I really like painting, but it turns out that painting introduced me to making jewelry, and I'm really great at making jewelry, and I really love making jewelry, and then that's what you'll do for the rest of your life. But never say no just because somebody else said that you can't do it. I really, really feel that if we all follow our own path and we all just push ourselves to be the very best of ourselves that we can be instead of trying to be anybody else or trying to emulate anything else or try and live up to anyone else's expectations, then we would all be a lot better off. The whole world would be a lot better off and healthier because we'd be living our own natural path.
And I agree. No one else should put our expectations out there. Our parents should not live vicariously through us. Our friends should not live vicariously through us. We should set our standards, our own standards, high, and then dare anybody else to knock them down. Would that be a fair statement?
Absolutely, yes.
So, whoever told my new friend Sarah, who now I will send the monkeys after if they try to tell her this again. And Sarah, they do fly, honey. Trust me. When you're in my coven of monkeys, they protect you. The next person that tells Sarah that she has an unrealistic dream, she will let me know, and I will send a legion of monkeys to give them a lesson in don't do that to people. Because, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a child and that child has a dream, don't be that parent. Don't do to that child what teachers did to me and what someone did to Sarah, because you don't ever know what other talents that child has and whatever gifts that child has. And like Sarah says, that might be what they want to do at the moment, but then it may lead to another dream that might not be fulfilled if the one dream is torn apart. And, yes, Sarah got the promoting under her belt, and she promoted bands and she stayed in the background. And that was a building block and a foundation to give her the confidence to be the wonderful artist that she is today. Would that be a fair statement, Sarah?
Well, I would think it's a beautiful compliment.
Well, I only speak the truth. Anyone that knows me will tell you, Yvonne Lee only speaks the facts. And while, sadly, it was a negative experience in the beginning, by you coming in through a back door, it has given you an even stronger foundation and the ability to withstand the bumps and bruises that as artists y'all do get. And anyone that says, oh, no, it's smooth sailing, they lie up, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And it's also, I really appreciate that it's given me a lot of music contacts. When we did our last tour, we booked it entirely on the good graces of the bands that I had worked with over the previous decade. And so if I hadn't have had that, if I hadn't have taken the pass that I did, then we wouldn't have been able to do that tour. We wouldn't have been able to do the ones that we have coming up. And then we wouldn't have been able to have built up a fan base at all. Nobody would have heard our music because we didn't have the connections. But thankfully, because I came up through the ranks the way that I did and put in my dues on the backside of things, we have a really great network of amazing people, like truly amazing people who are all about helping each other out. And so we help them and they help us and we all succeed together.
So what started out as a not so fun journey has come full circle, and now you are on the right path with your band of merry musicians, and great things are coming to you.
Yeah, I would say things that are really coming together nicely.
So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to have Sarah one more time give where she can be reached, and then we're going to bring her back in August because I will have music, and we will play her music and talk about her music and go and buy their music. Let's make these lovely, lovely people famous because, like I said earlier, this is my third band from Canada, and I am so honored, Sarah, that you agreed to come on this show and be honest and open up your heart and let people know that even though we have the struggles, and I'll be the first one to tell you, some days it's a struggle, but we still persevere because we're dreamers. Would that be fair?
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
So tell the folks where you can be found, my friend, and where they can go and get your music one more time.
The best way is at pandabeecatastrophe.com, and through there it'll link you to SoundCloud, Bandcamp, YouTube, everywhere that we have our music, our videos, and our merch.
And will you come back and visit with me in August?
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to. I'm touring a festival the weekend, the 11th to the 14th, so any other weekend or any other time but that weekend.
Okay, so towards the end of August we'll put you down. How's that?
Awesome. I'm in.
All right, and I'll get your music in between then, and I want to thank you. Our time, unfortunately, is up, and I want to thank you for spending this time with me. I'm very humbled and very, very appreciative, and I can't wait to
thank
have you,
you
back on.
It's
and if
been
you
a true pleasure.
On,
you're wonderful.
Well, I'm just me, honey, but thank you. And if you want to hang around with and hang around for the second hour while I talk to my cousin who is also an author, Ms. Dana Davis, you're welcome to hang with us if you want to.
Oh, cool. I actually have to run out and go see a Voltang show. They're staying at my house, and so I have to go support the band, but I'm going to be listening to your set as we drive across the river, or listening to your
All
show
right.
as we drive across the river. So I'll be
All
listening
right.
for the first 15.
All right, well, go and have a good evening, and I will talk to you before August so we can set this up.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me on your show. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for coming. I feel like I've made a new friend, and I appreciate you very, very much.
Oh, thank you. Have a great night.
All right, sweetheart. Bye-bye. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that was Miss Sarah McAdams. And she will be back in August. Now, my next guest is not only my cousin, but she is an award-winning author, Miss Dana Davis. She writes fantasy and science fiction with an entertainment background in stage and television. Now, this is her birthday month. I think today is her birthday. I think. When she's not writing, she loves to read, hike, travel, investigate haunted locations. She lives in Los Angeles with her husband, and she's like me. She's always writing another book. And she has the cutest little senior dog named Miss Sophie. Welcome, Miss Dana.
Hi.
Hey, honey. How are you?
I'm fantabulous.
Good. How is life treating you?
Life is great. And actually, my birthday is coming up this Sunday, but I'm starting like a special. I always try to do a giveaway on my birthday, so I'm starting that special thing we talked about today. And
sweet.
It's going to run through Sunday. Yeah.
Tell the folks the special thing.
Well, the special, I like to give away a freebie on my birthday to celebrate. So the special thing I'm doing this month is giving away Kindle copies of my latest book, Lost Moon. And you can either go to Amazon and type in Lost Moon and my name, Dana Davis, or you can go to danadaviswriting.com, and I have links, you know, to the Kindle book. But it is free through the weekend until Sunday. I believe Sunday evening is when it ends.
Why do you like, instead of getting gifts, why do you like to give away gifts?
Well, I love getting them, too. I don't know. I just feel it's a birthday, and every year that comes around is another year we've survived. You know, it's
like,
so, and I love my work. I love writing. I love entertaining people with my writing. So it's always a nice time to kind of give something away and share, and especially, you know, with all the stuff that goes on in our world, there's always bad news every time you turn on the television. So it's just nice to give people a way to escape. And I know, you know, some people sometimes they can't always afford to download all the books that they enjoy. And so it's, I don't know, I just enjoy having a little giveaway once in a while. I usually do one around Halloween, which is like my favorite holiday. And I'll, you know, I just kind of pick little holidays throughout the year. But always on my birthday, I try to do at least one giveaway.
Well, see, and we have that in common because they could do away with the silly season and just celebrate Halloween, and I would be a happy camper.
I have a few friends that think that way, too.
Personally, I think we ought to make Halloween a national holiday, close all the businesses, and make a really big deal out of it, decorate everything like crazy in the malls and in the shopping centers, and hang up things from the lamppost just like they do during the silly season, and they would be surprised at how happy people would be.
It would be great. You know, I know we didn't talk about this because I kind of remember what we chatted about the last time. It's been a few months, but when I was a kid, we did some trick-or-treating when I was really young, but then there was a tragedy in our area where a child was poisoned. So my parents decided that it was probably a good idea not to be taking candy from strangers. So instead of, like, a lot of the family would go to their own family and friends, and, you know, that would be their trick-or-treating. You know, they would make sure they went to people they knew, which I think is what some people still do now because some kids still trick-or-treat. But
uh-huh.
What we did was the city had this big carnival every year, so my parents got into the habit where they would just bring us to the carnival. And I think, if I remember correctly, you got in free, like entrance was free, and you got, I think every child got like 3 or 4 tickets for free, and so you could play those tickets at the, like, certain booths. And then they had rides and food, and, of course, then you'd spend your money on the rides and the food and that kind of stuff. But I remember doing that probably, I would say, around the time I was about 10 or 11, we started doing the carnival. And so that became our Halloween tradition. And then I really got into that. So we would do the contest. You know, they had costume contests and the costume parade and all that stuff. And then they would do, like local places would do haunted houses. And so we would start out in our garage. We would build the haunted house, and we'd bring all the neighbor kids in, and we would use the grapes peeled for the eyeballs and the spaghetti for the innards, you know, the standard gross your friends out stuff, and, you know, the spotlight, the little, the black lights and all those things we had back in the 70s when we were kids.
Uh-huh.
And then I would also, as I got a little older, I would help, like, local haunted houses, you know, the haunted houses, like the schools and things would do them. And so I would go and I would be a monster, or I would help them set up. Or so it just, it became, for me, it was just this fabulous holiday. It was like one of my favorite things to just scare the heck out of people. I'm surprised I don't write horror books, which I've thought about maybe I might venture into that someday, but I'm kind of surprised I don't do that.
And the thing is, ladies and gentlemen, what makes this even more interesting is Dana is a real big fan of Bewitched. She
yeah.
lives, eats, and breathes Bewitched. So, yeah, we should declare it a national holiday and just decorate everything, close all the businesses, have haunted houses. You know what you could start? You could start a Bewitched, not haunted house, but a path or a forest or a house or something, and have Tabitha and Samantha and Morticia and all those folks. Morticia wasn't in Bewitched, but Darren. You could do a tour of their house.
Actually, I toured the original house, the back.
I remember that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was like a really great, because it's hard to get. I worked in the industry in Hollywood for a long time, but I've been out of it for quite a while, so I don't have a lot of connections left, and most people have retired or moved on to other things. But my husband managed to snag a ticket. There was a special going on for the anniversary about 3 years ago. And so he managed to snag me a ticket as a kind of a belated birthday gift. And it was something I'd always wanted to do. Probably should explain why I'm such a Bewitched fan, because we did last time. But I was about two, three, you know, when the show started, because I'm about Tabitha's age. And I started watching when she came on. I was old enough to watch the show. And I wanted to be Tabitha. I mean, I had good parents and everything. My parents were great, but, you know, we were poor. And there was a lot of childhood tragedies that I witnessed and experienced, and we had foster children who had their own tragedies, and, you know, they would tell me their secrets, and so I would find out things that probably the adults knew but the children didn't tell them. So for me, it was this big escape, and to have this magical powers when you're this helpless child, which I think every child feels that, especially when they're little,
uh-huh.
you know, that you're kind of helpless to do anything and help. So I really wanted to be Tabitha. I mean, that became my first TV family. And I think that was when I went to I was supposed to make an appearance when I was three on a kiddie show, and actually ended up missing my entrance. Yes, my big debut. But because I saw the behind the scenes, and I really got infatuated with the industry. And so later on, when I kind of got out on my own, I went into that from stage, you know, dancing and stage, and worked my way up into commercials and getting into the industry and working on TV shows and movies and stuff. But that's kind of where the obsession started. And so now that I'm older and have, you know, we've saved up, have a little bit of money, and I can do some things. I like to collect some Bewitched items. I still, you know, I have the DVDs, I watch the show, and it brings like a lot of really happy, good memories of just kind of innocence. You know, the show was on before, I think right before the Vietnam War, I think it was,
yeah.
It was on before that whole era, which kind of changed a lot of the innocence for, I guess, the country. And you know, so other shows came on that kind of pushed it aside, and it became more of a children's, I think, more of a children's show. At least that's what I always thought it, for me it was. And then I watch it as an adult, and you see different things that you missed, you know, when you were a little kid. But that's kind of where the obsession comes from. And, yeah, I think the Halloween kind of goes along with it, the witches and the magic,
uh-huh.
and, you know, and I think there's still that little bit of, you know, wanting to have that magic in your life. And so I do it now by writing books. You know, I write fantasy. I write science fiction. I don't really like to write too much nonfiction because it's just not fantasy enough. I'm like, oh, that's too much real life. Yeah, do something that's not real.
And we get slammed by real life all the time. I mean, you walk out the door and you're hit with real life.
Exactly.
And people need an outlet. And ladies and gentlemen, Dana writes about strong women. And there's a history behind them.
Yes, all of my books have female lead characters. Whether they're girls, whether they're women, depending on the audience it's written for. But I always have women, and usually a lot of them, in the books, a lot of strong women characters. And, of course, there are strong men characters, but my main focus are the female characters in the books. And one of the reasons, because I was a huge reader as a child, my mother weaned me basically on all of the Grimm's, the really grim fairy tales, the gory ones, which I love, the gory fairy tales, the Mother Goose rhymes. I didn't really do, like, picture books. I wasn't really into picture books. To me, those were, like, the baby books, and I wanted the fantasy books. So I wasn't really into the picture books, but I loved these big, thick, old books. I think they were from the 1920s. I think they belonged to my great-grandmother or someone in the family. And so those are the ones we read. And my mother read them, and then I read them, and I read them to my brother, and I read them to my sister. And so I really got, you know, into a lot of the, you know, the fantasy world, and I'm forgetting where I was going. I guess so. Fantasy books.
Well, this in the older books, there weren't that many strong women. It was the men who were always the heroes, and it was always the damsel in distress.
Yeah, and the old, now, there were, it's funny, because in those old fairy tales, there were a lot of women in the books, and they were different than, like, the Disney stories. So I don't know if you've read the original Grimm's fairy tales, but the female characters in those stories were a lot stronger and a lot more self-supporting than the Disney characters, who were just looking for the princes to come and save them, you know, type thing. But when I was a kid, when I was reading, which was basically a lot of the science fiction and fantasy books in the 70s, there were maybe two or three writers that had strong female characters or a female character at all in the books, especially science fiction. Science fiction was very much male-dominated at that time, I think from the 50s or even the 30s. If you look at Tolkien, you know, Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, all the women hobbits are home. You know, they all stayed home. They didn't get to go on the adventures. So that was a big thing for me. I was always looking. I mean, I saw myself as these male characters in the books. I wasn't interested in reading a lot of the girls, you know, were reading, more of the romance stuff or the Jane Eyre of the time and stuff, you know, reading those types of books. I wasn't interested in that. I wanted the adventures. And all the adventures in the science fiction were the males. So when I began writing, of course, I don't think I did it on purpose to begin with, but I wanted girls. I wanted the girls and the women to have these adventures because I didn't get a lot. Now, of course, there's a lot more now. I'm not the only one writing that now. There are a lot of authors writing the strong female characters. And, of course, the whole, you know, in 90s through, we had Buffy and Xena and all these, you know, really the charmed ones and all these strong female characters. So, girl, I think a lot of girls today maybe may not see that. But for me as a child, it was pretty blatant as I got a little bit older. I'm like, where are the girls? Where are the women? You know, it was always someone's secretary or someone's mom or someone's sister who was over there, but they weren't part of the adventure.
And that showed up in television series, too.
Yeah, it really did. So I think that was another reason where Bewitched was such a strong influence on me, because here was this little baby, but I mean, she was me, you know, she was a little girl like me, and she had these powers that she could just wreak havoc in the adult world around her, you know. I mean, they would be scrambling, going, oh my gosh, Tabitha turned somebody into something, what do we do? You know,
and she did it on a regular basis.
She did, and her mom was, you know, this, even though, you know, the show is blatantly sexist because of the time period, you know, it was the 60s. But, you know, as the 70s came, the characters started changing a little bit. And the women's liberation came in. And so the characters themselves began to change. But, yeah, I watch the early ones now, and I'm like, that's a really sexist thing to say, you know. But it was the time period. That's the way it was. But, you know, she was there because she wanted to be. She loved him. She didn't have to stay. She could have, you know, taken off anytime she wanted to, because she was a witch and she was magic. She chose. And I loved, you know, even the male characters, annoying as some of them, sometimes when I was, you know, a kid, like, Mary Kate, why would you say something like, you know, like that? Why would you say that? Especially now, getting older, I think it's all nostalgia. And I'm big into genealogy, which this is how you and I met, so we know that.
Uh-huh.
You know, kind of looking back at the past and seeing my own family tree and seeing I look for the oddballs, you know, the people who are different in the family tree, because the ones who are different, those are the ones who actually had their stories written down. I'm getting off the subject of the strong female characters, but it's kind of related. So one of my ancestors back in the 1600s was a Mohawk Indian woman, and she married a Dutch man, man from Holland. When this was about the time when New Amsterdam, it's when the Dutch had settled before New York was New York. It was New Amsterdam with the Dutch, and then
right.
The British came in later, you know, conquered and that type of thing. But the Dutch and the Mohawk, which I didn't know until doing genealogy, I didn't really pay a lot of attention to that time period in history. Unless it was dinosaurs and ancient Egypt, I wasn't really that much interested in history growing up. But the history was that the Dutch and the Mohawks had, like, kind of trade agreements, and they would marry. They would intermarry quite a bit, which I didn't really know until I started doing genealogy. So my ancestor, she was with the Mohawk Indians, and they were big in trading beaver pelts. That was how they made their living. They traded with the other tribes. You know, that's how they did everything. Everything was bartered. You traded. You had something. Someone had something you wanted. You traded for it. Well, when the Dutch and, you know, everybody else started coming in, they were like, whoa, this is a big deal. We want to take control of this. So
uh-huh.
I think they said they didn't want the natives. So they're like, no, you're not allowed to trade the beaver pelts. We're going to be doing that now. Or you have to get permission to do that. And there was an article, I don't have it in front of me, but there was an article written down by the authorities where the marshal or whoever it was of the town, they were up in the Albany area in New York, went to her home because I guess someone found out she was trading, you know, beaver pelts, because that's what she does and her family had done. And so he went in to confront her, and evidently she threatened him to get out of her house because she was going to trade these beaver pelts. And
wow.
Evidently he ran out of the house, you know, and I'm like, that's my ancestor. You go, girl. And you got written down in history, and I, 300-400 years later, got to read it about, you know. So I just, those are the kinds of things I look for in the family tree. And way, way, way back, there's all these royals. You know, once you find one of them that you're related to, they all intermarried. So I'm related to just about every, you know, royal
uh-huh.
family way back, the Tudors, the, you know, all of the Plantagenets, that stuff. So that's a whole other side, which is really fun to look into. And, boy, there were some characters. Talk about your characters back there. I just, strong women are always, and my mother, you know, was a strong woman. I mean, she raised us. My dad went to work. It was kind of your typical 60s, 70s family where the dad went to work, the mom stayed home. But to me, I'm sorry, staying home with the kids, I'd rather go to work any day. That's the easy
me
part.
Both.
Give me the job. Yeah, staying home with the kids and raising them and the, you know, getting, because my dad, you know, that he would work and he would go to school, and so he was always, you know, busy. He'd come home late. Sometimes we were in bed when he got home. And so my mom kind of, you know, she did, that's what the moms did. They did most of the raising of the children and stuff. So, yeah, she was very strong to do that. And, you know, that I know that couldn't have been easy.
was writing something you always wanted to do, or was it something you had on a back burner? Was it something you fell into?
Kind of a little bit of everything. When I was little, I wasn't, you know, when I was too young to write, I would make up stories. I would make up things, and I would act them out in my backyard, and I would get the if there were neighbor kids around, I would kind of direct them. It kind of reminds me of, if you remember the movie Beaches, you know, with the little girl where she's telling the other kids on the beach what to do, and they're like, she's kind of bossy, you know. But I was kind of like that. I was like, okay, you're going to be this person, and you're going to do this, and you go over there, and you're going to come in when so-and-so says this. And so it was kind of this whole, I think what I was doing was I was creating stories, with my friends, or, you know, if they were around. If not, I would do it with, you know, rocks, and I was always up in a tree somewhere, or, you know, I would do it with later on with, like, little dolls and creatures and things like that. And then as I got a little bit older, I started, especially through, like, middle school and high school, I started writing actual stories and really, you know, bad poetry, angst poetry, all the stuff that teenagers do. But writing stories, and I remember, I think it was ninth grade, I turned in, we had, like, a creative writing section in English, and I turned in a story about this girl who found out she had a brain tumor, so she was in the hospital. And she was out walking her dog or something, and I'm trying to remember. I don't even know if I have a copy of it anymore. And the end of it, basically in the end of it, they found a cure for her brain tumor, because it had to be like a certain number of pages. You know, you're writing for school. And so she starts heading back to the hospital. She gets hit by a truck. And the teacher's like, hey, that's an A-plus figure. She had me read it to the class, and at the end of the story, the class was like, oh, no. but I wasn't seeing that as like my career. I was in theater, I was in dance, so I was doing that. But so I was storytelling. I was telling someone else a story on the stage, and eventually later on television or in films. You know, being part of that that story or storytelling. You know, a lot of storytelling in dance. You know, we did dance productions of Cinderella and Peter Pan and all these. So I always had a part, or some, as I got older, I got the leads, you know, for this telling the stories. So, yes, I was always telling stories, but as far as being an actual writer, I was doing that, but it was always kind of behind the scenes. And I started writing scripts for plays, and I started adapting children's plays when I started teaching children's theater classes, and the children would perform. But again, I wasn't seeing it as like a career move. It's really funny how I was just doing it, because I constantly had that in my head. I had to do that. But then when my dance career took a big hit, when I had to have knee surgery, which pretty much put an end to my dance career. And so when my husband, I was helping him get through school. I was working a couple different jobs. And when he graduated, he said, you know what, it's your turn. You get to go back to school, because I never got to finish. Said, you get to go back to school and finish your degree. And I said, well, I really don't want to do theater and film anymore. I've been there. I've done that. I kind of want to spend more time with you. I don't want to always be away from the house. And I love science, so I was looking into astronomy and, you know, all the archaeology. I'm thinking, yeah, but then I have to teach, which I was tired of doing that too. I'm like, I don't know what to do. And he's like, you're always writing. Jesus, like, why didn't you just get a writing degree? So I'm like, oh, yeah. You know, kind of like... It's like,
there goes the light bulb.
Yeah, exactly. You know, oh, yeah, I could do that, couldn't I? But then everything I started writing sounded like, you know, a script. I wanted to write novels. So I went back to school. I stopped writing the scripts. I really immersed myself in doing the novel writing while I was getting my degree. And then once I graduated, I really focused. I did some short stories, but that wasn't my favorite type of writing. I love the novels, and every time I would write short stories and turn them in class, they're like, you know, I think you need to write novels. I'm like, yeah, I'm thinking you're kind of right, probably. That's where I need to go with that. And so it just kind of segued, really. I mean, so in my head, I was writing constantly from the time I was a child. It was always in there, but I didn't, you know, as a career, it's funny that it took my husband to just kind of go, hey, hello.
Think about this.
Up.
Wise
exactly.
Man that he is. So,
yes,
y'all, you lived in California, and then you moved to the desert, right?
We did. We were here. It was 1998, and I finished my schooling. I had just graduated, and he was looking for the company he was with was moving out of state, but they were moving to the East Coast. And we went there. We looked at homes, but we just didn't want to make that move. That wasn't really our lifestyle. We were definitely West Coast people. So then he got an offer in Arizona. Of course, we had, you know, Californians are always vacationing in Arizona, Grand Canyon, you know, Tucson. So a lot of vacationing in Arizona, and we've been there numerous times. You know, there's like the big meteor crater. If you ever get to, if you haven't been, I go. It's just this fabulous nature there. And so he said, well, what would you think if we moved there? He said, because you can work anywhere now that you're writing. And I said, it would be something different. We, you know, we could get out of California just for a while. We'll move there for a few years, buy a house. Then we could, you know, sell the house and come back or whatever. And so I said, great. I'd love to get out of an apartment or a rental and buy a house, because everything's so expensive here. So we did that. We moved his career and just we built a home and had a swimming pool and just, you know, it was hot as hell in the summers. But, you know, the swimming pool helps. And I loved all the nature. We had trails around us in desert and there's scorpions and rattlesnakes, which I didn't like so much. But, you know, you kind of learn to live with that. So we really had a good time. Our time was like we set basically 5 years. That was our plan. You know, we're going to live there 5 years, sell our house, come back, be able to afford a house in California, in Los Angeles. And, of course, then the big crash, which everyone, the Great Recession happened. So we got kind of stuck. And then I kind of, as the years went by, I thought, well, you know, this is great. We're fine here. We're only an hour, you know, flight from L.A., 6-hour drive. We come back to see family and stuff. So it's not really a big deal. And I did miss the beach. We definitely missed the beach. And we definitely, in the summers, we missed California weather. But we thought, okay, well, maybe this is, you know, we're just going to be here. And then things started to turn around. And so he really started looking for jobs back home. We both started getting homesick. And so we said, you know, let's at least look and see. And so he started looking for jobs. And then his company there, he went through a couple different mergers. And honestly, every time they would merge, it was his company getting bought out. So, you know, the other people coming in, they start getting rid of the people with the company they buy.
Yep.
They're like, you know, that's nice. We're going to put our people here now. You've been great. So that started
happening.
See you
happening.
Later, Bob. Yeah. And
been
so
through a couple
decided,
of those. Yep.
Oh, yeah. And we've been through a few of those. And so he landed a job out here with a company that he'd been looking at for a while. And so we came back. And he's originally a satellite engineer. So he originally worked for Hughes Aircraft, building space, so a lot of the satellites that circle the communication satellites circling the globe.
Mm-hmm.
He was part of that or helped build them or was helping with, you know, keeping them running, communicating. So that was his job. And so he kind of moved back and forth between that and television industry, doing satellite TV and stuff, working on the tech side of that. So that was where, you know, we came back here so he could work more in the TV industry and stuff. And it's funny because we've been planning for him to early retire. And so this week is our big news is the fact that he actually finally was able to take early retirement. So he is officially retired. He's like, he's done now. He's officially retired. And so I'm putting him to work. He's going to be my marketing manager because he's got his MBA and all that stuff. So you know what? We're going to put you to work. You can do that. And I can concentrate more on the writing, which is what I enjoy. You know, so he can figure out where I need, you know, the books need to be promoted. Because even though I'm with a publisher, I'm with a small publishing house, but even my friends who are with the big publishing houses, as you probably know, they'll do a blast for you, but they don't do all the promoting and stuff they used to do back in the day. It's a big difference.
No,
you know, it's a whole different world now.
Yeah, it's up to the author and or slash agent or publicist to do the promoting because all they do is publish. They don't care. They just publish. And I knew when I got into this many years ago that I was going to have to do my own marketing. But then I've been marketing since I was 5 years old when I worked for my father, so it wasn't any big deal to me. And the key when I got into it was make the Internet your friend.
Right.
In fact, I think you and I had a conversation years ago that in order to, because we are considered independent authors, that you have to make the Internet, you have to put yourself out there through the Internet. That's the only exposure we have.
Yeah, because now I am doing some of my own publishing. I still have most of my books with my traditional publisher, but I'm also branching out, so I'm what they call a hybrid author, which is the new term.
Uh-huh.
So I do traditional through a publisher, but I also am doing some of my own publishing of my own, you know, doing my own stuff. And the whole reason originally that, because I'm very much a hermit. I was in the entertainment industry, which you find a lot of people don't realize it, but a lot of actors are that way. They're very private. They go to perform, but when they're performing as someone else.
Right.
Now, not everyone, but most. That's why you see a lot of the actors living in these seclusive areas with big fences around their properties because they don't want to interact with everybody when they're at home. You know, that's
they're
what
tired.
They do for work.
It's
exhausting. And so I got on, like, you know, when Facebook first kind of opened to the public, when it wasn't just college kids anymore, the whole reason I got on there was like this, you have to, you know, do that. You have to join Facebook. You have to join Twitter. And so, and then, so that was the initial. But what I found that's like this extra bonus is meeting it. Well, what's nice is you can get on when you want. You can you can talk to people when you want, and you can get off when you need to, when you need to take a break.
Uh-huh.
So I like that aspect of it. But I've also connected or reconnected with family members.
Uh-huh.
Old and new, people like that you and I have never met. We found each other. But also family members I hadn't seen it since we were children. And friends, like pretty much the whole high school and college people are on there. So now you know, I think reunions are pretty much a thing of the past because everyone's on social network now. So you can see what everyone's up to, that, you know, you don't have to wait 20 years to find out what your friends have been doing. They're all there, and everybody kind of knows what everyone's doing. So
it opened up a whole new reader base for yourself.
I did, but it's just nice to kind of reconnect sometimes with people and just, you know, I enjoy seeing pictures of, you know, people's puppies and little, you know, I love puppies and kittens and the whole, you know, I'm kind of girly that way. So I love little kitten stories and puppies. And it's funny because I'm not really big on babies. There's a lot of those out there. But, you know, like my niece just had her little baby and she's cute and everything. Oh, yes. But as far as if there's a choice between a baby and a puppy, I'm going for the puppy every time. just know
it
that.
Take the puppy. Take the puppy. Because the puppy will go in its crate and go to sleep, and you don't have to worry about it.
Well, plus you can leave them home when you need to go to the grocery store, right? You don't have to take them with you.
Except mine has anxiety issues. Your books are, and I know we talked about the last time, but we may have a whole new audience out here this time. Who knows? Are they mostly for young adult or teen?
Most of them are for adults. Most of the books are for adult reader. They're not erotica books. I write that genre. That's a different genre. But they're written for adult audiences. So there's, you know, violence and sometimes there's sex and, you know, that type of thing. So they're written for adults. But I do have three novels that are written for, like, young teens, like maybe 12 to 15, 16 years old. Two of them are back in print. In print and on Kindle, and they're on my website. And then the other, the third one is out of print right now, but I'm hoping, because I've got the rights back to that one, I'm going to republish that. I'm hoping to get that one out by the end of the year, but I'm still working on my next adult science fiction that's supposed to come out the end of this year. So if that one doesn't come out by the end of this year, it'll be republished by next year. But no, the majority of my books are definitely for adults. Now, I say that, but I know when I was that age, I was reading adult books from middle school. So, but I don't want to get myself into trouble and say, sure, kids can read these books, because then, you know, then the parents might get a little upset. But teenagers have read some of them because I do have younger characters in some of the books. But when you go to my website, you'll see one that's like Teen Adventures, and that's the page for if you have kids that age group, like 12 to 15, 12 to 16. Those are the books that are geared for them that don't have as much, you know, as the sex and that type of stuff, which I know they'd love to read, but I know the parents and the teachers don't want that. so they're, you know,
now, you
they're
are,
a little,
speaking
a little
of kids,
down.
Speaking of kids, you have gone to schools and given talks about your teen books, right?
One of them, yes, I do. Every year, there's the one called The Mask of Camarilla, which is a post-apocalyptic novel. It was way before Hunger Games, all this stuff was written. But the teachers are using it as a teaching tool, as a teaching aid, finding the themes and using the characters to help. And some of them are the special needs classes so the books, you know, they can read about characters their own age, but they don't have to worry about reading all the sex and some of the things that they don't want them, you know, the teach, or they can't because it's school, you know, they have to be
right.
Selective with some of the books that the children are reading in school. You know, when they're home, they're going to read whatever they're going to read, which is
And
what
I've read the mask. I've read The Mask of Taramella, and I love that book. It was an extremely excellent book.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed writing that one, and the main character, Kate Lana, would not let me sleep until I wrote the book. I wasn't, you know, it was just kind of that's how the book happened. I was taking a writing class just to refresh myself after school, you know, after I had graduated. A friend was teaching creative writing, so I was taking her classes she was basically just, you know, writing. Here, you have 20 minutes, get an idea, you know, or she'd put things out or put pictures out and say, you know, look at these pictures and get an idea and just write for 20 minutes. Don't think about it. Just write. And so that came in during, like, the very first little spark of that story came in the classroom. And I thought, oh, that's, you know, a little classroom thing. And I put it aside. And then I think it was that night or the next night I started having her coming into my dreams. And she would, you got to write my story. You got to write my story. There's a lot more to this. And that's, as you know, that, well, for me, that's how the characters work through me. That it's like this voice, my subconscious keeps saying, you have to write this. And then they don't let me sleep. They don't let me do it until I start writing. It's okay. You know, it's like that kid at the store.
Yeah. Yes,
mommy, mommy, I want the ice cream. I want the candy. You know, so
and you
want to, yeah, they don't
want to sleep. And they won't let you sleep.
Yes.
They refuse to let you sleep.
They do. And so, I would have to make sticky notes and just leave them everywhere. So that's, and then of course, once I got into it, I just was in it and I was writing it every day. And then I workshopped it and people, you know, I had my beta read and all this, that whole, the editing part and stuff. And it got written and rewritten and rewritten and then marketed. And it took about 10 years and I finally got a publisher to pick it up for me.
And then after The Mask of Taramel, and I'm probably mispronouncing it because I'm brain dead right now, what came out next? Because you've written so many, I can't keep up. I can't keep up with my own books. But after that you started a series, didn't you?
It was a couple novels because I started out doing some of, wrote that one. I thought, well, I'll write for the teens. You know, I'll write a couple books for the teens. I was enjoying it. You know, it was fun. I was enjoying doing it. So I wrote... I wrote two more for the teens. One of those, which is still out of print right now, but will be coming back. So I wrote a science fiction and I wrote a fantasy. So one is the post-apocalyptic, and there's one sci-fi that has aliens and everything in it, and then there's another one that's strictly fantasy with magic and things like that in it. And then I was living in the desert by this time, and so I moved into doing, I wanted to do something different. I wanted to write for adults, but I wanted to do something a little different from the fantasy science fiction. So I started going, I was doing some paranormal investigating with a group that had invited me with them. And so I started writing paranormal, like ghost stories, which are my favorite. I was never personally myself into the vampires and the werewolves, other than like Buffy and maybe a couple other TV shows. But I was always very interested in the ghosts and the witches and the mediums. And I think because we have family stories of my great-great aunt, who was a medium around like the 1910s, 1920s, that era when it was really, the occult was big. You know, everybody was kind of into it. And she was, you know, the family stories of her being a medium and a telekinetic and just family stories of what she had done. Now, I wasn't there. I don't know if they're true or not, but they intrigued me. And, of course, it was related. I'm like, ooh, witches, bewitched and magic. And she could think, move things. And so that's always stuck in my head. And so when I started writing, I kind of took little nuggets of those family stories and put them into the characters. And as soon as I started writing the first chapter of that book, that it just, the characters started flooding in. And I said, okay, I thought, I'm going to write the book. And I thought, maybe I'll write two or three books. It'll be a series. And it ended up being five books, which for me was long because I'd only ever done just kind of single novels at that point.
Uh-huh.
But it was, the thing that made it different was it was paranormal fantasy, but it was taking place in the here and now, our world, not on another planet, not on another time. It was here and now, but the characters, you know, have magical abilities, and there are all kinds of different types of characters. So that was a whole different type of writing for me, and I really got into it. And I finished the series a couple of years ago, the last book was published last year, but I finished it a couple of years ago. So that series called Desert Magic, and each book has, you know, a different subtitle, that series is complete now. But that
and
was the big...
Were they were set... If I'm not mistaken, it's been so long since I looked at them, that was why y'all were in Arizona. So you had all that scenery to use,
yes,
in those books from the desert.
I
you
did.
You could look out your window and see all
I,
of the beautiful
I did,
things.
And I started having to really pay attention to everything that was, because I would walk the trails and I would have my headset on and listen to my music and I would just get out there and exercise and just enjoy being out in the fresh air and stuff. But I really had to start paying attention, because then I was going to start writing about it, because all of my other worlds were things I'd created. So I would have to do that in my head and do all that preparation. But I'm like, well, now I'm doing it in this world. So it needs to be, people need to feel that they're really here in Arizona, you know, driving the freeway when my characters are driving the freeway, or driving the surface streets, or, you know, walking out in the trails or seeing the mountains. So they, I really had to work for me, for myself, to make sure that I did that as real as I could and make that a real world. And then the characters, making them real, but they have, you know, these magical abilities. So that was a big, huge exercise for me.
And what people don't realize, if they've never lived in the desert area, is that the desert is different in the daytime than it is at night. It's a completely different environment at night.
Yeah, it's it can be it's dangerous, but it can be a lot more dangerous when you can't see what's there. Just like I said, because of the snakes and the scorpions and the coyote and but it's, if there's something kind of, it's like the beach. It's like being at the beach at night. There's something kind of magical about it also. I mean, it just, I think, well, especially the area we were living in. I mean, because, you know, you have the downtown areas, which is kind of your basic downtown everywhere. But when you're out, we were kind of on the borders in the preserved areas where they made sure when they built the homes that they still had all this nice open desert around you. So sometimes it was never totally quiet, because you would always hear the birds and the creatures and the critters and things scurrying, and so I really had to kind of pay attention to, you know, and then of course you'd have an airplane go over, and then it brings you back, like, oh yeah, I'm kind of in the suburbs here, you know, not really in the middle of the desert, but you felt like, and you could be in the middle of the desert, and people did that, and sometimes they did that when it was 110, 118 degrees, and they got themselves into big trouble, because you cannot survive without, you know, your water and your hat and your sunblock. And when it's that hot, you don't go climbing the mountain. So they were always rescuing tourists. You know, the tourists are on. I'm like, you know, that you can't. You really have to be super, super. It's like being in Minnesota in the winter or Canada in the winter. You can't just go out in your jeans and your jacket like we would in California. You will freeze to death. So
you have to be prepared.
It is, and it's its own climate, and especially there in Phoenix, where you have the saguaro, the big saguaro cactus. That's how they're pronounced. Like some, if you hadn't, some, I hear people saying saguaro, and because it has the G, but it's pronounced saguaro. And those, they're beautiful cactus, and they're, most of them are hundreds of years old. By the time they start getting arms, you know, they're like in their 70s type thing. But that's the only, kind of the only place. I think there's a little slice of California, maybe a tiny little slice of Mexico where you see the saguaro, but mainly they're in the Phoenix, Tucson area, like that southern, middle and southern Arizona area. So it's completely different. You know, you think of someone in Europe is reading your books, or even someone in Canada who's never been there reading those books and they've never seen it other than photos. It's amazing, because you don't realize how big and how heavy these things are until you stand next to them and you realize you're this tiny little person, you know, and there's birds and things living in them. It's just, they're just amazing. And that was one of the things. I still miss that about the desert. You know, I'm like, I still miss my saguaro and all that stuff.
What people also don't understand is the desert is really the desert. It's not made up. It's wild. It's, some of it's uninhabitable. It's full of danger, like you said. And then it has all the wild beauty about it. And I think that's when people get lost, is they forget that they're in a danger area.
Yes, exactly. And especially after you've had some rain, it's like California, because California basically is a desert. It's just, everything's been tamed. You know, people brought the water in. The ancient Indians there brought the canals in, you know, for water. And then some of them just disappeared, but, you know, we think they just migrated on because everything was in a drought. But you have drought years, and you have years where it's not so much drought, you have more rain. But when you have the big rains before spring, a lot of times you get these gorgeous carpets of flowers. And in California, we get carpets and carpets of the California poppies and other flowers. And in Arizona, you would get all these beautiful different types of Arizona flowers. And then, of course, everybody gets, you know, the hay fever and the allergies that you don't realize. I never had allergies till I lived there. And you don't realize that. And it was several years before I got them. But it's absolutely beautiful. But if you go and take a hand without a glove and you're even in your own backyard doing, and you reach underneath a bush to pull something out, you could find yourself a rattlesnake or, you know, something, a Gila monster or something else living under the brush there. So, yeah, it's this beauty, but it's this underlying danger, which, you know, like I said, each state has its own type of this thing. You have states where you have, you know, bears and the kind of danger. But it's, I think it is, especially here, it's different. It's a different, because it's kind of the only area where you have the desert, you know, with Nevada, Arizona, California, that whole, you know, Utah, the desert area. And the formations are different because you don't have all the vegetation. When you get all of the rains and floods that stop them, so they would run through, and they've carved these, you know, through the millennia, just carved gorgeous plateaus and all kinds of, you know, formations in the mountains and the rocks and the history. People during the gold rush would come out to the Superstition Mountains, which is where a lot of the scenes in my book take place in the Superstitions, where they had gold mining. Way back in the 1800s, and people were killing each other looking for gold. You know, so it was the Wild West. I mean, that's exactly what it was. When people think of the Wild, Wild West, it's, you know, Tucson and you know, the shootouts and everything. So and honestly, you saw the dust, you know, the rolling dust and the big, huge dust storms that would come in and just blanket the entire area. And they're fabulous to watch, but God, you don't want to be stuck in one when you're on the freeway. You know, it's the last place you want to be is in your car. But it is. It's beautiful, but it's deadly. And so you really have to be careful and know what you're doing and what to look out for and what to stay away from especially when you're out hiking and things like that.
And when you did those five books, all of that came out in your books, all of those descriptions came out in your books so that the reader felt like they literally were in that desert.
Thank you. I was hoping, that's what I was hoping for, you know, at least in the first, you know, when the series starts, because you want to start at the beginning and read the series, to really get the feel of that throughout the books. And then as I got more into the series a little bit later, then I felt I didn't have to do quite as much of it, you know, because the scene was set, so I was hoping. But still, yeah, I still had to remind myself, even towards the later books, you know, I need to really kind of a little bit of reminders of people of where they are and what's going on. But that was the hardest thing for me because it was real life. It was a real life place. So I had to be very careful. I couldn't just, you know, now there were some fictional places because I wasn't going to, you know, pick out the local mom and pop store and put them in my book because of some bad things were
going
on.
But anybody that was local that read the book would know exactly what you were talking about.
Yeah, they would know wherever they lived in their area. They could have, it was kind of like they could feel, yeah, that they kind of knew the general area of where I was and where, and of course the mountains that I name are real mountains and the cities are real cities. But then I would change, you know, I would change the names of, if I was at the local grocery store, just say the local grocery store, you know, that type of thing. So keep that, vague that, you know, as Buffy would say, vague that up. But the scenery in the mountains, yeah, the desert, the javelina, those are all things that I encountered and things I saw when I lived there. And we lived there for 14 years, so I thought I had a really good, you know, good basis. I wasn't a native there, and we had visited numerous years before that. We had visited and seen, you know, all kinds of sites and things. So, but it was a different experience living there. And, yeah, there's still aspects of it that I miss. I don't miss 120 degrees. Some people say they like that, but you have air conditioning. When you know, like our air conditioner went out one summer for like a couple of days. It's not so fun when you don't have modern convenience.
You get used to the modern conveniences.
Even in the swimming pool it is. And the pool would get warm. You don't realize, but, you know, the pool would be bathwater temperature when it's that hot. sometimes we were throwing bags of ice, you know, to try to cool the pool down a little bit because it felt like getting in a bath because it was just so hot.
Well, let's go back to the new book, Lost Moon, because if we don't talk about Lost Moon, we're going to run out of time, and then people will go, well, they didn't even talk about Lost Moon, and that's the freebie. So what is Lost Moon about? We just got carried away with the beauty of Arizona. What is Lost Moon about?
Well, now, Lost Moon is a straight fantasy novel, and it's just a single novel. It's not a series. It's a single read. But my husband and I like to travel. We've traveled, well, the past few years we haven't done a lot because we came back, we were buying and selling house, and then, you know, we have our elderly dog and she's had some problems, and so we're going to be traveling once the pets are gone. But we did a lot of traveling all over the world through the years, especially we lived in Arizona because, you know, with my husband, he had to travel for some of his jobs, so we had a lot of miles that we needed to use up, and so we took advantage of that to be able to travel. And one of the places, you know, Northern Europe and stuff, but one of the places we traveled to during that time was just Alaska. We went to Alaska, and I visited with my cousin. I have family up there, and we saw just, you know, the icebergs and the glaciers, and it was just a whole different world again.
I love Alaska. I love it.
Yeah, it was just, it's gorgeous and dangerous, but really gorgeous. So one of my characters in the book lives in Alaska. That's where she starts out. But the book is a fantasy, so the majority of it takes place on a completely different world, different plane. A lot of magic, a lot of danger. There are three main characters, three women main characters who are thrown together. And of course they don't particularly want to be together, and they don't want to be doing what they're supposed to be doing, but it's basically a prophecy type book where this was prophesied and this is what you're going to do. You're going to carry out the prophecy, and if you don't, then, you know, there was going to be some major repercussions, such as the world, you know, your world, as you know, will be destroyed. So that's the overall, the big, you know, theme of the book. And then, but it's a single novel, straight fantasy. It's definitely not for children. It is for adults. Now, if parents are okay, you know, older teens, I'm sure they want to let their older teens read it, but the book itself was released on Halloween of last year, so it's a brand new book, just came out in October, Halloween, so it's just a few months old. So it's about 5-6 months, so it's a new book, and I wanted to make sure people got a chance to get, because most of the free books are always, you know, the older books, the ones that have been out a while, and or like the series books, you always, you know, the first or second book, you want to get people kind of into the series, and hoping that they really enjoy your worlds and reading about it, because they can't read the later books, you have to read the first ones. So this one's standalone, and it's like I said, it's a new book, so I'm hoping that people will really enjoy and take advantage of this time, because it ends on Sunday, so once Sunday's done, that's it. You know, the book's not free anymore, it goes back, well, it's, I think it's $3.99, the main, you know, it's not a lot of money as far as the Kindle, but it's also in paperback. So I know there are some people who don't enjoy reading ebooks and they want it in paperback, so it's also available in paperback too for anyone who wants to read that.
So let me ask you this. You want to come back on Halloween to give your freebie on Halloween too?
Oh, that would be intriguing.
Because, you know, Halloween's my favorite night. Halloween is your favorite night. We could maybe play some spooky music, and you might have a couple of new books out. And
ooh, I could tell some ghost stories, like my family ghost stories.
Yes, that would, we could do
fun.
That, too.
Wouldn't
that be fun?
Well, and also some of the paranormal stuff that I had been, you know, because I did a lot of I've done several investigations, paranormal investigations. Everyone probably remembers, you know, the ghost hunters and things that were big on TV and stuff, but I did in real life. So it's a whole little different than what you see on television. You know, that's all Hollywood kind of. Yeah.
Want to do that? That'll be fun.
Yeah, that sounds fun. Yeah,
okay.
I need to mark that on my calendar right now so I don't forget.
And when I get back to my book, I'll put it in my book because I got it down on my notes. Bring Back Halloween, October 31st.
Oh, yeah, that'll be fun. It looks like it's on a Tuesday, too, so that'll be nice.
Yeah, we'll do a special Tuesday show. Well, no worries. That'll be fun. Okay. It's a date, ladies and gentlemen. Put it on your calendars. Dana Davis and I will be doing a Halloween special. It'll be creepy. Yeah. It'll be eerie. And it'll be fun. It'll be kooky.
Yes.
Well, hey, I'll even find the Addams Family theme song and play it.
Oh, that'd be cool.
Because that was my favorite show. I love the Addams Family. Morticia.
I enjoyed that show.
She was my hero.
I can see that. I enjoyed that show too. I remember watching that and the Munsters. You know, all those
they were
shows.
So misunderstood. That's what was so. They weren't evil. They were Wednesday might have been, but.
I love her. She's my favorite character.
She was so funny. She had such a dry personality. I could relate. She was so sarcastic, and she didn't understand why they didn't understand.
Exactly.
And Pugsley was so cute. He was just as cute as he could be. Now, where can the folks find you, my dear?
Well, the best way to find kind of all of my social, I don't know a lot of social media, is just go to my website, which is danadaviswriting.com. You know, the name is just so rare that danadaviscom was taken. So many of us. So if you just type in Dana Davis, you're going to get probably 3 million of us coming up. But danadaviswriting.com. I have links on there where to find Twitter and Facebook and the blog and Pinterest and so people can go there and peruse the website at their leisure. And also, Lost Moon is on there, so they can go to that page and get the link if they're interested in the free Kindle book to download that. But they can read about the other books. And then I have my YouTube link on there, too, because I have some book videos, you know, book trailers, so if they want to go and watch the book trailer for the series and the different books. And if they have teens or no teens, you know, so pretty much that's probably the best place to get the overall everything, and then they can go in and look at whatever they want. There's also some extras. I have some of my genealogy family, especially some of the royals, quite a bit of the royals listed. But there's also some, just some free stories, little short stories and things that I'd written and gotten published years ago. So those are on there just, you know, free for people to go in and read. Some of them are just kind of funny and others are, you know, a little less funny, a little message or something. But yeah, a couple of them are a little maybe good for a Halloween read, maybe.
Hey, but yeah, maybe you can read one of those short stories for Halloween.
Oh yeah, that's really a good idea. Let's look in there.
Yeah, we'll have a whole hour to play with.
That sounds like
fun. We can cram a lot in an hour between the two of us.
That's true. That's very true. Well, thanks for having me. This has been great.
Before we close, you know, I was doing my dreamer thing at the end because I believe that without dreamers, we wouldn't have art and music and trips to the moon and technology and telephones and all
exactly.
the things that we have. So, and I know I asked you this the last time, but I always like to ask my guests this. If you had someone come to you, and fortunately your husband was your supporter, he's the one that said, go for this, make this happen, and he stood by you and supported you throughout all of this, even retired so he could help you do it, bless his heart. But if someone comes to you and says, I have this dream, but I have no support, I don't have this, it's just my dream, and I don't know what to do with it, what would you tell them?
Actually, which is one of my favorite things to do, is research it. You know, no matter what it is, if there's with the internet, you can find information on anything. I would go in and research whatever. Like my grandfather worked for NASA, so I kind of grew up with the dreamer. I mean, you know, we saw guys go into space and go to the moon, and you know, I mean, but he, you know, in the 70s, he worked there. We got to go watch the rocket launch on the family beach. You know, like the movie Hidden Figures. That's what we did. We went to the beach and watched the launches in the 70s, watched the launch. So anything you're interested in doing, and I know it's tougher. Sometimes it feels tough. You don't have the support, but you have to be the support for yourself, and you have to create the support. So do the research. Find a group that is Like, I was such a nerd and a geek. I used, before I did a lot of this, sometimes, which I didn't mention, I also wrote fanzines, were basically sci-fi, fantasy, television shows on Star Trek and some of these shows where we would write, like, stories and things and then sell them at the conventions, at the science fiction and fantasy conventions. And that's how I met other people with my interest. And so you start basically networking and meeting people who like the same things you like, and then you start supporting each other. So basically, if you're whatever you're interested in, if it's dance, go take classes. If you don't have a lot of money, go down to your local rec center. And actually, that's a good place to get started with anything. If you're not sure what you want to do, or if you're in school, some of those GE credits that you need to take for college, that's the time to experiment. Take the classes. If you see something you like, take it, and that will give you a good idea whether it's really something that you want to do. Seeing the end, we see the end results. We see the books. We see what the writers have done. But what you don't see is the years and years of work and practice it takes to get to that point where you actually can publish, and the editing and the rewrites that go on, all the work that goes underneath it to support the book
and
so
the
that it's
pulling
ready
out
for
of one pair and the lack of sleep
and some of the books that don't make it. I've got the as everyone, my first ever book I ever wrote will never see the light of day. That's not ever going to be published. That's the practice. So you need the practice. You're not going to be, playing Carnegie Hall, with your violin unless you start taking lessons and learn it. So it's basically find the beginning of it, find what you're passionate about, and just jump in, go in, find people who, if you go to classes, you'll find other people who are interested in the same thing, and start there. And then they will, your instructors, people who are doing a little more with it will be able to kind of send you the right direction, what you need to do. Talk to your counselors, advisors, if you're a young person or even an older person, in school and having a new career, go to your counselors. That's what they're there for. They will help you. If you're in high school, you go to your counselors. They will help you find that career, that choice, that kind of get you going the right direction of what you want to do. So that would be my advice, just starting out. Find groups. Go online. Find groups who are, interested. You don't want to get with some once in a while that you're going to find this, and I think it's probably anywhere. You'll find somebody who's trying to tear people down because that's how they think they're going to build themselves up. So you want to stay away from those type of people.
Absolutely.
And you want to find people who are going to support each other, and you want to make sure that you are giving support also to those other people. So that would be my advice, really, to start out that way.
And I heard this the other day, and I've kind of made it my mantras. If you want to achieve greatness, you've got to stop asking permission. You just go out and do it, even if you have to go it alone. And ladies and gentlemen, I had to go it alone because a lot of people told me no. And I want to thank those people.
Yeah.
I want to thank
them.
If
you're like me, which I think with this, the family trees and everything, but I think if you're like me, when someone tells you can't do something, that would give – I mean, they would be like, oh, yeah,
watch
me.
Just
so
watch
that was – yeah, that was – yeah, watch me do that.
If you can't go over a mountain, ladies and gentlemen, you go around it. If you can't go around it, then you go through it. If you can't go over it, around it, or through it, then you just move the damn mountain.
Or me, you just create your own.
There you go. Just don't be afraid to fall down, because that doesn't mean you failed. It just means that you pick yourself up and you're a little bit stronger. So
you need to fall down.
You need
to fall down. Exactly. You need to fall down so that you can pick yourself up and dust yourself off and say, okay, I did that. Look, I'm still alive. Hey, look at that. I fell down and I didn't, I'm okay.
So
I'm just going to keep going.
You see a baby learning to walk, they fall down, they get up, they fall down, they get, and eventually they can walk a straight path sometimes.
Yep.
So if your child has a dream, if you have a dream, if your spouse or significant other or whatever has a dream, your best friend has a dream, don't be that person that says you can't. Don't be that person that, as my previous guest heard, that's not a realistic dream. Don't be that person. Because it is a realistic dream. Because we have another mantra on this show, and I know that Dana has heard me say it and write it, dream big or go home.
Yep. And, well, my mom used to tell me to keep one foot on the ground and one foot in the clouds.
There you go.
And that was said, and I've never forgotten that advice, because you have to be practical, but at the same time, you know, you want to have the dream. So it's basically a walk in two worlds.
There you go. Now, tomorrow night, ladies and gentlemen, Brittany Quagan is going to be my guest. And so be here at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Dana, thank you, my darling, for once again being on my show and spending an hour with me. I always enjoy you, and I appreciate you so, so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
We have traveled the path together, have we not?
Yeah, pretty much. We've known each other quite a while now.
Yeah, we have. We have traveled the path together. So, ladies and gentlemen, understand, if we can do it, you can do it. And at the end of your days, don't be that person. And all of you who listen to the show know what I mean when I say don't be that person. Don't be that person laying on your deathbed and someone says, do you have any regrets?
Yep.
You want to say, no, I've done everything I've wanted to do and more. So until next time, which will be tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, I say thank you for listening. And I say thank you for my guest for being here tonight. It's always an honor and a pleasure. Without my guest, we would not have a show. And I will go put you down, Miss Dana, for October the 31st.
Woohoo!
So until next time, sweetheart, and then when this goes up into archives, I'll send it to you, and I'll send the podcast to you tomorrow, too.
Fabulous, fabulous, and I'll share it away.
All right, sweetheart, until then, I'll say good night.
You're listening to Love Advice with Leanne. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Leanne. Longtime listener, first-time caller. Why, in your professional opinion, do you never take my calls off the air?
Is this Carl?
Yep, it's Carl. I mean, we had a few dates. Everything was great, I thought.
Well, you know, when you switch to GEICO, you could save a lot of money on car insurance.
Okay, awesome.
You should call them.
I will.
GEICO, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
Are you ready to lose those love handles? Do you work hard to stay in shape and eat healthy, yet you can't get rid of stubborn fat? Now there's a clinically proven way to help you look slimmer without surgery or downtime. It's called Sculpture. Sculpture's innovative procedure destroys fat in just 25 minutes with visible results as quickly as 6 weeks. Sculpture sounds amazing, right? Check it out for yourself by clicking on the banner or go to goodbyefat.com.